Good afternoon. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Delia Benz King. The Eco News Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, Eco News. Today, my guests are Lisica Parrott, the BLM interpretive specialist at the Arcata Field Office, and Dan Barton, who's a wildlife professor at HSU. Thank you for being on the Eco News Report today. Welcome, you two.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
So today we are talking Seabird Protection Network. Yes.
Yeah, that's an exciting program that we're beginning here on the North Coast. The Seabird Protection Network, it's a multi-organizational collaborative that works together to reduce human disturbance to seabirds and other marine wildlife along the California coast.
So before we jump right in, let's introduce you two a little bit and give a little background about yourselves. So do you want to start?
Sure. I work for the Bureau of Land Management in the Arcata Field Office as the interpretive specialist. So I work on a lot of education and outreach programs on BLM lands from Humboldt to Mendocino, Trinity County area. Yeah.
I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Wildlife, and I've been at HSU for about 5 years, and I'm involved in diversity research projects in the North Coast region, but lately, particularly with seabird conservation and seabird population biology.
Great. So, first of all, let's just define seabird. I mean, it's pretty obvious by the name, but I'm not sure about the details exactly what makes a bird a seabird specifically. You want to take that one on?
So seabirds are often defined as birds that wholly depend on marine resources for food. And however, birds are all constrained to come back to land to nest. So seabirds are often viewed as a sort of a bellwether of changes in marine ecosystems. And they're also particularly vulnerable to disturbances on land because most of them evolved in situations where they were using sort of isolated islets or rocks or islands on the open ocean that protect them from predators and the sort of risk of being disturbed by predators. And so they are often particularly vulnerable to disturbance events at colonies.
So can you give an example of some types of seabirds?
Sure. Here in the North Coast region, there's a diversity of seabirds that span kind of a wide range of phylogenetic diversity or birds placed at various places within the sort of overall tree of birds. And they include species like pelagic cormorants, double-crested cormorants, and branch cormorants, as well as storm petrels, including leeches storm petrels and fork-tailed storm petrels. And some more familiar species perhaps as well too, including tufted puffin. The most abundant seabird nesting in the area is common murre. And there are also seabird species that visit the North Coast region from elsewhere to obtain food resources, despite the fact that they nest hundreds or even thousands and thousands of miles away, including shearwaters, which migrate from the Southern Ocean to exploit food resources along the California coast, and albatrosses, which fly all the way here from Hawaii and then back to their nesting colonies on the Northwest Hawaiian Islands on a single foraging trip while they're nesting.
Wow, amazing. Quite interesting. So, of course, these birds are very important and also beautiful and an indicator species, as you're mentioning. So that's why you have the Seabird Protection Network, I'm assuming. And can you explain a little background about the Seabird Protection Network, how it began, and where exactly it spans?
The North Coast Seabird Protection Network is just in its infancy. It's just beginning. We had our first kickoff meeting last week. There are other seabird protection networks along the California coast, mostly in central California. So this is a first stab at monitoring and doing education outreach on the North Coast.
And what are the goals of the protection network?
Well, the goal of the Seabird Protection Network is to address human disturbance to breeding seabird colonies in the hopes of enhancing the recovery of seabird populations damaged by oil or other contaminant spills along the Central California coast.
So in the North Coast, would it be doing the same thing?
Yeah, the funding that supports the Seabird Protection Network comes from the oil spills that happened that impacted seabirds in 1999 and 1997 in Humboldt Bay. And so the trustee council of that particular oil spill decided that this was a viable project for the North Coast. And the North Coast is very ripe for an outreach effort for seabirds here locally. And so we're really excited. Our kickoff meeting was a very exciting meeting where we had a lot of local partners that are important stakeholders in seabird protection.
Yeah, that meeting was definitely interesting. We were all there, and yes, definitely the room was filled with all kinds of people. And so, I mean, there's lots of different partners involved, and I'm curious how you two got involved in this, because this isn't your job specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, can you explain a little bit why you're involved in your role in bringing this to the North Coast?
Well, I just say, first off, that we're really, really lucky to have Dan Barton. I don't know if this would happen without his presence. He's relatively new to the area and, well, not new to the area, but new to this project and, you know, us getting involved. He's immediately engaged with seabirds. So we're very lucky to have Dan. And I think it has a lot to do with David Ledig putting together a funding request that really is funding this effort forward with the Oil Spill Council for the next 5 years and hopefully on into the future. So on my end, that's where it began. But I think, Dan, you can speak for yourself, but I just wanted to give you that.
Well, Lisa, you're too kind. but I think that, you know, HSU's involvement in this and sort of my interest and involvement in it is, you know, I'm a professor of wildlife biology. My job is to primarily to educate students on the sort of future of wildlife conservation and the tools required to do effective wildlife conservation. But I also view sort of, you know, this local community as being part of my constituency as a professor at a public university. And, you know, working with agencies and the local community to provide science-based conservation and input into the conservation process that includes scientific data that we're collecting is sort of a key role for faculty at a public university. And I started working on seabirds in this region in 2013 as part of the California Marine Life Protection Act, Marine Protected Area process, and have been working with several other seabird researchers in the region, including Rick Golightly, who's now a professor emeritus from Humboldt State University, Phil Capitolo from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Dan Robinette from Point Blue Conservation Science, formerly known as Point Reyes Observatory. And we've all been working together to develop, as part of the MPA process, what's called a baseline for seabirds in the region. And that sort of naturally got us involved, and Point Blue, I should acknowledge that they're involved in the Seabird Protection Network development as well, and they've been involved elsewhere. They got us involved in working with the sort of nascent Seabird Protection Network here in the Bureau of Land Management, and Lessica, who's also invaluable to this process given her ability to sort of work with a lot of the different stakeholders involved and her knowledge of the sort of interactions between local land management agencies and the community at large.
Yeah, and I'll just mention, I also, thank you, Dan, some people might ask, why the BLM? Like, why us? And so I'll just throw in that we manage the California Coastal National Monument, which runs the span of the California coastline from Mexico to the Oregon border. And all those rocks and islands, about over 20,000 rocks and islands along the coast of California that we are responsible for, the Bureau of Land Management. And David Ledig, who I mentioned earlier, is the California Coastal National Monument manager, responsible for overseeing the management of those rocks. And he works with us locally in the Arcata Field Office, and specifically Trinidad is a gateway to the California Coastal National Monument, where these seabirds nest, and it's a pretty important habitat for them. So that's the connection.
Great. You mentioned the marine protected areas and the baseline research project that you're working on. Can you explain a little bit more about some of the data you've collected and maybe some trends you've seen?
The MPA process supported a diversity of projects for monitoring to establish baselines here in the North Coast study region, which extends from approximately Point Arena all the way north to the Oregon border. And our project, which I've mentioned some of the collaborators previously, that includes HSU, University of California, Santa Cruz, and Point Blue Conservation Science, we have been collecting several different types of data in the region. The first one is working with a series of different partners that have been conducting aerial surveys of seabird colonies within the entire region over the last almost 20 years at this point. And so we've gone back through some of those aerial photos of colonies and established the numbers of birds and changes in the numbers of birds over time in a lot of these colonies, mainly focused on common MERS. And In addition to that, we also collected a lot of shore-based monitoring data. So what we're doing there is we're observing nests over time through a season and looking at whether or not they fledge young and how many young they fledge if they do. And the main study species there are common murres and branch cormorants through a camera system that Rick Golightly and Castle Rock National Wildlife Refuge have sort of spearheaded placing on Castle Rock to monitor seabirds remotely at that colony. We've also been doing shore-based monitoring efforts where we literally just sort of stand on headlands and observe seabird colonies through a spotting scope and follow the fates of nests at those colonies over time. And then in addition, we've been looking at where seabirds forage in relation to these newly established marine protected areas. And we're sort of asking whether those MPAs provide potential benefits to seabirds through perhaps increasing their forage base. And so if they do, we would expect that the distributions of seabirds shift. And one of the sort of key things there that seabirds provide to folks that are studying marine ecosystems is they're easier to count than fish by virtue of the fact that they breathe air and breed on land. And so they are often sort of used as a tool to understand what's going on in ecosystems. And that leads to this term indicator species that we think they indicate something about change in the marine environment.
So have you seen from your research, do you think that marine protected areas are doing what they were designed to do? And specifically the special closures are these smaller areas centered around, like you're mentioning, rocks and areas that seabirds, their habitats, basically.
Well, the MPA process designated a series of different kinds of marine protected areas throughout the state of California. And some of them are essentially no fishing zones or various kinds of limited take zones. And those were established through a complex and sometimes contentious stakeholder-driven process in this region about 4 or 5 years ago now. And in addition, there's also special closures that you mentioned around seabird colonies. And those are essentially seasonal or year-round no-entry zones that are designed to reduce disturbance. And I will say that I think that at the moment, the jury is sort of still out, and we're still analyzing data regarding whether or not the no fishing areas provide direct benefits to seabirds. And, you know, the variability of marine ecosystems, you know, we had a big El Nino event in 2015, often makes it hard to establish over short-term studies whether or not certain management actions actually provide direct benefits to something, an apex predator, which they really are. Seabirds are apex predators. Whether or not MPAs provide benefits to predators like seabirds, because they're so wide-ranging. You know, they don't just sort of stick to one small marine protected area. They may go hundreds or even thousands of miles on a foraging trip. But on the other hand, I don't think I'm going out on a limb at all, and I think there's a very strong scientific consensus that reducing disturbance at seabird colonies has benefits to seabirds. And if the special closures established as the part of the MPA process really do result in reduced levels of disturbance at seabird colonies, then they are certainly going to provide sort of direct benefits to seabirds.
Yeah, and so your baseline studies are done right now, but you're going to be continuing long-term monitoring, is that right?
Yeah, so the MPA process was to develop a baseline. And at this point, we are done with the field data collection component of that project. But as part of my sort of ongoing work at HSU with seabirds, and also as part of this new Seabird Protection Network chapter, we're going to be continuing various kinds of seabird monitoring, but sort of specifically from Little River Rock up to about Muscle Point at the north side of Patrick's Point State Park, which encloses what we're calling the sort of the Trinidad area here. That is the target of the efforts of this Seabird Protection Network chapter. And so we'll be continuing to do various kinds of monitoring within that region over the next 5 years.
Yeah, awesome. I think this is a good time to mention that you are listening to the Eco News Report. I am your host today, Delia Benz-King, and I'm speaking with Lisica Parrott, BLM Interpretive Specialist, and Dan Barton, the wildlife professor at HSU, and we're talking about the Seabird Protection Network today. And I wanted to jump back into something you said earlier, Dan, about the camera. There's a camera on Castle Rock, And Castle Rock is off of Point St. George, right?
Yeah, so Castle Rock is off of Point St. George, and Castle Rock is the largest single island seabird colony in California. And in terms of size of seabird colonies, it's second only to the Farallon Islands out in the Gulf of the Farallons, kind of off of Marin County, further south. And about 10 years ago, as part of efforts to investigate the sort of basic biology, as well as the population biology and conservation of seabirds on Castle Rock, which is wholly contained within Castle Rock National Wildlife Refuge, managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Rick Lightly and collaborators, including Eric Nelson, the manager of Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge, established a remote-controlled camera system. And we have used this camera system in various ways. One of my graduate students just finished her master's thesis using this camera system to investigate Brandt's cormorants' nesting success over the last 5 years at the site. Steph Schneider, who's a master's student down at Moss Landing Marine Lab, is using the camera system to study MERS and MERT diet. So one of the really interesting things about this camera system is because it's sort of robotic and remote controlled, it allows Steph and Rick to actually identify what species of fish MERS are bringing into their young. So it helps connect what's going on in the seabird colony to what's going on in the marine environment much more directly that way. And, you know, that project is ongoing thanks to the efforts of Rick and the refuge. And we used it as part of our MPA monitoring work in 2014 to just sort of establish a baseline for what's going on in that colony. And then they're continuing to work with those data in other ways. And Castle Rock is outside of the scope of the Seabird Protection Network chapter at Trinidad, but there are other MERS colonies that are also very large within the Trinidad area. And so the sort of third largest complex of seabird colonies within the state of California is at Trinidad Head. So behind the Farallons and Castle Rock, we've got White Rock, Pilot Rock, Blank Rock, Green Rock, and Flatiron, which together host about 80,000 individual common MERS, at least as of June 2014, as well as thousands of other seabirds.
That's so amazing. I had no idea that we were that high up on the list of seabird populations here. So we've been talking about how cool they are and everything, so the only thing is we don't really want to go, okay, I'm going to go out and go and paddle over to this rock on my kayak and go check them out. I mean, of course, we want people to experience nature, but so how can we go out and see the seabirds without disturbing them? What's the proper way to go and view the wildlife?
Oh, that's a great question, Delia. And I think that's really what the Seabird Protection Network is about, is determining what the, you know, that human disturbance monitoring, determining who, you know, what user of the area is impacting these seabirds, and through this human disturbance monitoring. And with that, we would do some outreach education to those particular user groups. You know, it's the breeding season. When does the breeding season begin, Dan? When, kind of what are the dates that would be the most critical time for the common MER in those populations?
Well, common MERs tend to start breeding in April. And they are often present at the colony nearly year-round. Mm-hmm. They sort of roost on these colony sites during the non-breeding season as well as the breeding season. Mm-hmm. But they really start to lay eggs in this region in late April or May. Mm-hmm. And they are sensitive to disturbance at those breeding colonies essentially year-round. And the consequences of disturbance by humans, you mentioned kayakers. There's also been documented disturbance events in the North Coast, controversially due to fireworks further south on the Mendocino coast, or sometimes due to aircraft, or even sometimes accidentally if people become sort of stranded on one of these seabird colonies in an emergency and have to be rescued by the Coast Guard. That can result in an abandonment of nests, so sort of loss of eggs or chicks for the seabirds that are breeding on those islands. Or sometimes if there's repeated disturbance events, colonies will really just pack up and move or not breed at all during particular years. And so the sort of range of sensitivity to disturbance kind of depends on what species we're talking about. But, you know, this question of how do we enjoy seabirds given their sensitivity at seabird colonies? Well, there's lots of opportunities to observe seabirds in the wild, not at colonies. You know, we regularly see them off of boats in the area. We can see them foraging and what kind of fish they're grabbing sometimes in species like common MERS. And in addition, it's fairly easy to go up on, say, Trinidad Head and look through a spotting scope and see literally tens of thousands of MERS nesting on Flatiron Rock. And that's a spectacular opportunity. I've had the opportunity to visit seabird colonies in Alaska and Mexico and Hawaii I've been out to the Farallons, and I have to say that, you know, maybe we get sort of jaded to it because it's right here, but Trinidad Head is easily one of the sort of most spectacular sets of seabird colonies that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, we do a tour on Trinidad Head for Godwit Days, and I do all kinds of field trips up there with local schools. And, you know, and I partner with the Trinidad Coastal Land Trust in doing some of these tours. And, you know, in April, when Godwit Days is happening, we can, you know, we bring spotting scopes, and it's like a virtual, you know, common mirror, San Francisco, downtown San Francisco. I mean, it's packed, you know, and once you realize what you're looking at, that is just a solid colony of birds, it's pretty incredible. So, yeah, that's, you know, just getting people to enjoy them from a distance and, you know, providing some education. You know, I think we would use the results of the data collected from the monitoring and, you know, develop some education outreach materials that would be relevant to the group disturbing the seabirds. Part of the Seabird Protection Network is making the interpretation and outreach very relevant. For instance, if a low-flying aircraft is determined to be the cause of human disturbance to seabirds, through the monitoring process, we might outreach to local and regional pilots with a map and seabird information so they're informed and can avoid, you know, disturbing the nesting seabirds during that really critical time that Dan mentioned.
Yeah, especially people with drones now.
Huh. Right? Yeah, that came up at the network, at the meeting. Yes.
Another user group. What are some other user groups that might not think that they're disturbing seabirds, but you could actually be on accident?
I think all boaters, you know, anybody on the water, around the rocks, that's pretty, you know, obvious. Also coastal hikers. I think that there are, one of the citizen science monitoring locations is on Wedding Rock, is that right? And so there's a population there that could be disturbed just by a coastal hiker. And then, like I mentioned before, aircraft. And there's definitely outreach, you know, to local agencies like Coast Guard, trying to work with them during breeding season.
And, you know, one of the great things that I've learned pretty quickly about our North Coast community here is that a lot of the sort of, I guess we'd call them stakeholder groups that, you know, use our local oceans in various ways, they actually will ask questions of me, and they'll say, gosh, you know, are we disturbing seabirds? What can we do to reduce the amount of disturbance we're doing to seabirds? And I just want to give a shout out to the Explore North Coast Kayaker Club, who asked me, you know, that exact question a couple months ago during a presentation I was sharing with them about our work on marine protected areas in the region. And so I think people are very concerned. And so what we're trying to do as part of this process is develop some science-based sort of guidelines on how to reduce disturbance, as well as to do some science on and understand just how much disturbance is going on and what the potential consequences of disturbance are. And there aren't that many people in this region, but we do like to get out and sort of enjoy the ocean and play on the ocean, and thinking about the potential impacts of that on other resources we enjoy, like seabird populations, is important.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's wonderful how involved our local community is and willing to take that extra step and learn. You know, I love to be outside, but how can I enjoy the environment and protect it at the same time? So if you're a interested stakeholder, potentially interested stakeholder, how do you become a part of this group?
Well, I would love it if they could contact me specifically to so that I can get them on our mailing list. We did have a stakeholder meeting that included a lot of local stakeholders in Trinidad, in the area that we're looking. You know, Audubon was present. So I guess it would be my, you know, to get send me an email or a phone call to connect me so that I can include you. So should I give you?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
If you want to give your email.
So yeah. So my email is lparrott. So it's lparrott@blm.gov, and my phone number, my office phone number, is 707-825-2313.
Perfect. And are you going to be having any more meetings coming up, or will you just send out an email? And is that the best way to find out what's coming up next?
Yeah. Well, last week at our kickoff workshop, we really developed an action plan as a group, which is pretty exciting. And so there will be another meeting likely in February to review that action plan after I sort of put it all together for the group. So if you'd like to be on that mailing list, please contact me here at the BLM office in Arcata and let me know, and I will add you to that list so that you can review the action plan and be included in future mailings.
Awesome. And can you just be any person, or do you have to be a part of some kind of group?
I think at this point, I'm really kind of reaching out to a wide array of people to, if you have information or if you're a user and have questions, I'm kind of looking for all of that information at this point. So yeah, feel free to contact me and we can talk about that.
Great. Dan, do you have anything else to add to people wanting to get involved? Any next steps for your research?
Well, I encourage people just if they haven't seen the sort of spectacle that are these seabird colonies out in the region to, take a walk up Trinidad Head and look down on Flatiron Rock from up there and check out what over 50,000 common murres looks like. You know, it's a real amazing thing, and these colonies represent a sort of a spectacular natural resource that I think we often forget is sort of right on our doorstep. And besides that, happy holidays. I guess this is the holiday edition of the
It is. And what a better activity than to get outside and go for a hike with your family and check out some of our amazing seabirds to enjoy this holiday.
Yeah, and actually, there's a Redwood Adventure Quest that was developed by Humboldt County Schools in collaboration with HSU and BLM on Trinidad Head, and there is interpretation on that quest that you could do with your family. It's really geared toward children and families, and that talks about the common murre and its egg and its special shape. So I'll leave that the mystery. I encourage yourself, you can pick up those in Trinidad at the museum or at the city office.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, both of you, so much for being on the Eco News today.
Thanks.
Dan, this is number 4 or 5?
This is the 5th Eco News report I've been on this year. Scott Greeson and I did 4 about Malheur, and so this is number 5.
We need an award for you for the most. I bet you're the most.
It's 10% of the Eco News reports.
Well, I think I will wrap up then. This has been the Eco News Report, and my name is Delia Benz-King. I've been your host for the past half hour, and I was speaking with Lisa Caparrot from BLM and Dan Barton, who is a wildlife professor at HSU. We were talking about the Seabird Protection Network. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Tune in again next week for the Eco News Report.